Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll have a report on the Jefferson County Republican Party, where it stands and how it's preparing for upcoming elections. First, over the last 4 years, the number of arrests in Louisville for manufacturing methamphetamine has nearly doubled. Police say it's the result of increased vigilance by officers and citizens in recent years. But as Gabe Bullard reports, authorities acknowledge that just finding and arresting manufacturers and users isn't enough to keep the dangerous drug off the streets.
There's your meth pipe. You can smoke it, you can inject it, you can inhale it, a little bit different than smoking.
Louisville Metro Police Sergeant Stan Salyards is going through slides of meth labs, paraphernalia, and statistics on his computer.
We now have 44 found meth labs this year.
That's 44 lab busts from January 1st through April 22nd. It's just under the 56 total lab busts in 2006, and not yet half of the 93 recorded in 2008. The ingredients and materials needed to produce meth can be purchased from pharmacies and hardware stores. Louisville is often a destination for area meth manufacturers because of the prevalence of those stores. Salyard says it's possible that the jump in arrests is the result of a rise in meth manufacturing, but believes it's more likely the spike in lab seizures corresponds with a police program that teaches civilians how to identify residential meth labs.
Meter readers, people who pick up trash, LG&E, the water company, anybody whose job it was to go onto somebody else's property, we started training them on how to identify meth labs.
Anytime you've got that type of approach where you're trying to mobilize the public, you're going to uncover more crime.
Gennaro Vito is a criminal justice professor at the University of Louisville. He and fellow professor Geetha Suresh are doing a study of the LMPD's meth task force. Their analysis is not complete, but the two say the numbers appear to support Sergeant Salyard's claims. They've also noticed trends among the people arrested for making meth.
This is not like marijuana where they're growing it to sell or something along those lines. Here the meth manufacturer is also the meth user.
Since it can be made in the home with relatively little expense, meth is easier in many ways for users to obtain than drugs like cocaine or heroin that have to be imported from other cities or countries. And Suresh says arresting people for manufacturing meth under the existing law has not proven to be a deterrent.
We can find a definite pattern that people are being released and then arrested again.
Manufacturing meth is a Class B felony that carries a 10 to 20 year sentence. But prisons are crowded and meth labs are so toxic that not all of the evidence can be kept in storage. Meth-related convictions are common, but probation and plea agreements are too.
I think the longest time that I was incarcerated was, I think, like 38 days.
Stuart Cornelius was arrested 5 times for trafficking or possessing methamphetamine, but says he never made his own drugs, and jail wasn't enough to scare him away from using meth.
You know, the addiction is so intense that even as hopeless as that was, I still got out of jail and picked right back up.
Criminal justice professor Gennaro Vito says that's not unusual.
It's something that, you know, you need more than just the enforcement side to really do something about it, to have a heavy-duty impact.
That's what Cornelius says he got with the Jefferson County Drug Court. It's a program that offers rehabilitation to addicts as an alternative to prison. Cornelius says he's been clean since he started the program almost a year and a half ago.
I have about 6 months to go to be done with the drug court program, but I'll be in a 12-step program for the rest of my life.
LMPD Sergeant Stan Salyard says he supports rehabilitation programs for meth addicts, but there is another way to keep meth manufacturers off the street.
My personal opinion, I think manufacturing methamphetamine is violent because of the possibility of the fire explosion and also the chemicals that can be inhaled. I think it's a violent crime.
Violent offenders don't qualify for drug court, but if convicted, they also wouldn't qualify for the same paroles and probations they do now. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Louisville area Republicans lost a lot of ground in 2006 when Democrat John Yarmuth claimed the 3rd District congressional seat from the GOP's Ann Northup, who held the office for 10 years. Yarmuth defeated Northup again last year, and the presidency and Congress have also shifted into Democratic hands. Now, the Louisville GOP is making some adjustments as it plots strategy for next year's local, state, and federal races. Stephanie Sanders caught up with some local Republican leaders to find out more about those preparations.
Kentucky may be in the red state category, but it includes a sizable blue chunk, Louisville. Brad Cummings is the Jefferson County Republican Party chairman. He says winning elections for his party has always been tough here.
We always are fighting an uphill battle as a Republican Party here in Jefferson County. And that's why it's really important for there to be a strong county party that can stand up for our candidates.
Cummings says Ann Northup's five-term tenure in Congress is proof it can be done, but there's no room for mistakes.
We have to be very, very good at getting our message out in a much more effective way than the Democrats probably have to.
In the Democratic push that led to the election of President Barack Obama and a majority in Congress, a lot of credit is given to the support of young people and first-time voters. Adam Cochran is the chairman of the Jefferson County Young Republicans. He's at the front of an effort to reach out to young people and recruit them into the party. Cochran says he has to cut through a lot of stereotypes and misinformation to get to the core of the conservative message.
But we have to say, look, you know, Republicans are people with a moral clarity. They know right from wrong, and they make their decisions based on their own free will and choices, not on the government's.
Cochran says the GOP faced two major obstacles with young voters last year. Candidate Obama was successfully painted as the hip choice, which carried into other races, and the mindset of young people has changed.
They have a greater sense of entitlement than ever. Whereas I'm not for that. I'm for you earn everything that you get. And you shouldn't expect to get a trophy for coming in dead last.
Deanna Brangers is the chair of Kentucky's 3rd District Republican Party. She represents Louisville at the state party level. Brangers says instead of rethinking conservative platforms, Republicans should embrace their core principles.
We have strayed from those, and that is part of what has gotten us in trouble. And I think we do need to come back to what makes us Republicans, what binds us together.
Brangers says that trouble includes voter backlash over the approval of government bailouts in the wake of the nation's financial crisis. As for ramping up for the 2010 elections, she is optimistic the party will find the right candidates at all levels.
Not only are we putting together what I would call a very strong candidate recruitment effort and looking for candidates in every office, but we're having people to call us that are wanting to run for office. What a great problem to have. It's not a problem at all.
Jefferson County Republican Party Chairman Brad Cummings says while it may seem to outsiders that not much is happening within his organization, a lot of work is being done behind the scenes.
We think this is the most important year. That the work we do in 2009 will prep us for 2010. Otherwise, you end up constantly running behind yourself.
That work includes candidate recruitment and fundraising right now, and Cummings says it will get busier over the summer.
It's really important for us to have all gears going right now so that we are a well-oiled machine in 2010.
So would you say all gears are going right now?
I would say 80% of gears are going right now.
For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
In 1993, President Clinton signed the National Community and Service Trust Act, creating the Corporation for National and Community Service and AmeriCorps. Often referred to as the Domestic Peace Corps, AmeriCorps recruits individuals to serve in communities of need stateside. Addressing such issues as public health, clean energy, education, and financial literacy, AmeriCorps strives to be a valuable resource in strengthening local service networks. Janelle Ray spoke with Eileen Kakowski, Executive Director of the Kentucky Commission on Community Volunteerism and Service, about the mission of AmeriCorps.
On April 21st, President Obama signed the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, which reauthorized and expanded the mission of the Corporation for National and Community Service, under which AmeriCorps falls or operates. Can you tell me more about how the Serve America Act will impact your organization?
Absolutely. What happened, we were created in 1993, and we have not been reauthorized since. That means that every year we have to go to Congress and beg and beg and beg for money. And they usually write us out each year just to get the community to come together and say, no, we need this. And we have tried each year to be reauthorized. When you're reauthorized, you get money for a period of 5 years. And so this is a big thing for us. The first time since 93, we are now going to be safe until, I think it's 2014.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that it will do over the period of those 5 years is increase the number of members from 75,000 to 250,000, which is an incredible increase. Kentucky is a small state. You know, we're 26 in population. We have about a little over 4 million people. But because we're 26th in population, we don't get a lot of members on a formula based by population. And we've tried really hard to work with Congress, work with anyone on explaining small states need extra help. And so the new act has said that if you are rural and isolated and remote, you can have more members serving, that the population equation is going to take that into account, which is really good. Again, the amount of money for the award will match the Pell Grants. We'll have summer of service incentives for school kids during the year. We're even going to get some special innovation grant funds, something like the block grants, to be able to work it in communities. They're going to expand a lot of the things for older Americans, more foster grandparents, more RSVP or retired senior volunteer programs, as well as more AmeriCorps programs utilizing simply senior citizen enrollment or membership. Trying to think what else they're going to be doing. For the first time, they're going to be offering grants to organizations that are not state commissions. They're going to be doing some things through individual not-for-profit organizations, which is going to be very helpful. It used to be also that if national organizations wanted to put members in a state, they didn't have to talk to the commission. And now the commission is going to oversee that to make sure that lots of people receive service instead of a few people receiving lots of service.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's my understanding that the monies from the Serve America Act won't actually be distributed until October. And that's assuming, of course, that they can find the money, considering the current economy, to support the mission of the Act. What are your plans in terms of incorporating the Act into your daily operations?
You're very optimistic. The Act doesn't take effect till October 1.
Okay.
Which means who knows when the money follows that.
Mm.
We do not expect it until the 2010-2011 program year.
I see.
We really think that between October of 2009 and September of 2010, they're going to come up with all the parameters, all the policies, the ways that each piece of this will be carried out, and then we can begin to use that money in a year.
Mm-hmm.
We do have something else, though, a little bit of in Kentucky, and that's some of the stimulus money.
Mm-hmm.
And we have probably 7 programs who will be receiving some of the stimulus money to increase the numbers of members they have in their program. So that's probably going to be the little stopgap that helps us until that act is in actually in service.
Mm-hmm. What other ways has the economy affected volunteer service?
You know, I was thinking this morning, most of the nonprofits receive their money from individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And now a lot of those individuals are going to the same nonprofit receiving services. So it's almost a double cut for the nonprofit. Not only are they not getting the dollars in, but they're spending more dollars because people are needing more.
Mm-hmm.
Volunteerism has gone up primarily in the youth area as people realize the need. And it is. It's our youth who are looking around for the first time and saying, you know, something is really wrong here, and I can help.
Right.
And I think it's one time when they're treated like adults, they act like adults, and it really works. I think they will begin a lifelong volunteer service pattern.
And I would imagine that an opportunity to provide long-term service is also an opportunity to gain job skills.
Of course it is. That happens also with our AmeriCorps members. They do not join to become for job training. But you know, if you have a volunteer or you have someone who who you already know, and they're doing a good job, and they've learned so much, it's just common sense that it's good to hire them.
Mm-hmm.
When the economy changes, hey, there they are.
Absolutely. Well, in thinking about the federal money to support national service, how do you respond to critics that say national service is paid volunteering? Federal money shouldn't go to pay volunteers. It's somewhat of an oxymoron.
I absolutely agree. I 100% agree that volunteers should not be paid. AmeriCorps members and national service members are not volunteers. We call them members or participants, and unfortunately, you have really hit one of my soapboxes. Words are the only thing we have, and we need to be clear in our words. AmeriCorps members recruit volunteers. Volunteers are not free. You have to have programs for them and be ready for them. But AmeriCorps members must give 1,700 hours of service. They must be there every day, unlike a volunteer position that's there maybe once a week. There is a specific service they must give, and for that they get a living allowance. The living allowance is a little over $11,000 a year, and it's taxed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, volunteers aren't paid. And yes, I heard it in Congress the whole time, and I heard the argument. But national service members are.
Right. And my understanding is there's been a sort of a dollar amount placed on the value of a volunteer hour. So all of these AmeriCorps members who are recruiting the thousands of volunteers across the state and across the country are, in essence, increasing the capacity and the ability of other organizations to do their work without as much cost. I believe the figure from the independent sector from 2008 is that a volunteer hour is about $20, $20.25 an hour.
You're absolutely right, and you're absolutely right in everything you said. A volunteer does not add to your bottom line. If you don't have a volunteer, you can't use that money for something else. But a volunteer is a top line. They extend your services. They are able to get your name in the community. They help with fundraising. They help with everything you do. And I think it's very exciting to realize that while volunteers are not paid, they certainly can do a lot for your organization.
That was Janelle Ray speaking with Eileen Kakowski of the Kentucky Commission on Community Volunteerism and Service. To find out more about AmeriCorps, the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, or local volunteer opportunities, visit our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Gabe Bullard interviews a public radio executive director who's trekking the Underground Railroad by bicycle. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer has a report on the tradition of inviting popular recording artists to sing the national anthem at sporting events. First, in the 19th century, escaped slaves seeking freedom on the Underground Railroad had to deal with vigilantes, search parties, and the constant threat of being found and forced back into servitude. Pat Crawford of Pensacola, Florida, is currently retracing some of their steps, and he's encountered curious dogs and hopeful Southerners. Crawford is the executive director of WUWF Public Radio. He's riding his bike along one of the Underground Railroad routes from Florida into Canada as a fundraiser for his station. Crawford stopped for a rest in Louisville last week, and Gabe Bullard asked the traveler about his trip, the American landscape, and how to deal with roving packs of pit bulls.
What have you learned so far? Are you stopping in towns on your way on this trip as well?
Yes, and I am almost exclusively camping this time around. That's sort of my goal, is I'm trying to camp. When I have an opportunity to camp in a campground, that's great, but that's not always available. It's not always when I end up, is there a campground? So I've had some great experiences going in these small towns and just asking them, hey, is there a safe place to camp here? And there's some funny places I end up. I camped in front of a fire department one night. because the mayor said, well, we want you to be safe and we want you to be taken care of. So you camp in front of the fire department and they'll probably invite you in and feed you and let you use their showers, which they did. And it was great. One little town in Alabama, it was literally just a crossroad. That was it. And the only thing in town, really, business-wise, was a little dairy bar right at the crossroad. And so the people at the dairy bar said, well, you can pitch your tent right outside the dairy bar. And I thought, okay, that's fine. And the weather started to get a little funky, and the lady who runs the dairy bar, she said, well, I'm worried about you. It's going to rain tonight. How about when we close tonight, you come on in here, and I'll just lock you in the dairy bar, and then I open up at 4 a.m. for the truckers, and I'll be back to open the place up, and that way you'll stay dry. So that night I slept inside the dairy bar in Coffeyville, Alabama. So been some very interesting places. People have been very kind to invite me into their homes or let me camp on their property or in their yards. So it has been quite an amazing adventure so far.
And so do you chat with them just about other things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because that's just as I did on the walk. I really wanted to sort of take the pulse of the American people and find out, you know, what things are on their mind. How are they feeling? And particularly with what's going on now as compared to 2 years ago. And I'm glad to say the mood is still very positive. It's very good. Most of the people in these small towns are hopeful. We even talked some politics. It was funny. I'm wearing a jersey that says the Underground Railroad route, and I just was riding down this country road in Tennessee, and there was a guy sitting on his front porch, and he had a Confederate flag. He was flying in the front yard, and I thought, well, hey, this would be an interesting guy to talk to. And so I went up, and he was welcoming and gracious, and we talked a little bit about politics, and he said, you know, that he really hoped that President Obama could do something with what's going on in the world, and that we all needed to give him a chance. And time again, it's been funny. These people that I meet in these little towns, they say, particularly when they find out I'm associated with the media, they said, well, you know, you're the problem. And that if people would quit paying attention to what they're seeing and hearing on the media, we'd all be better off. Because, you know, there's a lot of good things going on in this country. And unfortunately, it's just the wackos and the people that are not right that want to get attention to themselves. And they're the ones the media always focuses on. So that has been sort of the resounding message I've been getting from these folks across the board. And so it's been great. Had some great conversations. And everyone has been extremely nice, extremely welcoming. I haven't run into anyone who's been the least bit threatening or not hospitable.
The way the economy's taken such a turn, have you found that in some of these small towns there's a different feeling than there was 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think they're worried. I mean, I think they're worried like everybody is, even in the big cities, and they're facing the same things. They're seeing layoffs, they're seeing businesses close down, and some of these small towns are literally on the margin anyway. I mean, they barely have enough business to keep things open, and when this happens, so you're starting to see more and more things close, and I've found it interesting, these maps that I have some notes on them, and they'll talk about, well, there's a bike shop in this town if you need to get your bike tuned up. Well, I'm finding that the bike shops aren't there anymore. They've gone out of business. And this is a map that was just printed probably a year ago. So you are seeing the impact, but I'm still seeing people pretty hopeful. I mean, they're not, I don't see people in these small towns quite as nervous or quite at the level of desperation of a lot of the people that I see in the more urban areas right now.
Are there any other trends you've noticed or any other changes or memes as far as how people are feeling, what they're worried about, what they're hopeful about?
Well, I think number one, they're just worried about the economy. And most of them, the majority of the people I meet, want to see the president succeed. They think he's a good guy. They think he's got insurmountable odds, but they worry about what the implications of some of the policies he's enacting right now are going to have for their kids and their grandkids in terms of paying back all this. But yet they're glad that he's doing something and that he's trying different things, and they are hopeful that they'll work. So I still think there is a lot of hope out there.
And is this a feeling you think that is mostly in the South right now, since that's been your experience so far, going from either Florida to Washington or Florida mm-hmm. to Louisville?
Well, I think so. And of course, obviously, that's where I've been focused. So that's the main perspective I'm getting. But yes, it seems to be pretty consistent across the board. And I don't see a tremendous difference from even 2 years ago to now, even in spite of all that's happened in the past 2 years. Still at the grassroots level, and I make it a point, I don't ever stop and eat at like the chain restaurants. I always seek out, I always ask somebody, where do all the locals go? And so I'll usually have my meals at the local restaurant or the mom and pop restaurant. And that's where the locals, you know, they're just like family. You go in and you immediately know that everybody there probably goes there every day. That's their social time. That's their meeting time. But yet they don't treat me like a stranger. They welcome me right into the family. And as soon as they find out what I'm doing, they want to know about, you know, where I've come from. And then I ask them about how things are going. And it's just interesting to hear their conversations. But they are hopeful. So that's encouraging.
Is there a conclusion in particular you could draw about people now that you've seen them 2 years apart? Not the same people, of course, but is there like a conclusion about just a spirit that people might have?
Sure, yeah. The American people are innately good. They're just good people. They're good, decent people trying to make the best of, you know, the cards they've been dealt. And they are extremely open to strangers. There's not a fear of a stranger coming into town. They always are very curious as to what I'm doing, very welcoming. And it's interesting. One of the things that inspired me to take the walk was a book by Peter Jenkins called A Walk Across America. And he wrote it back in the early 70s. He had just graduated from college, and he was very disillusioned because back at that time, of course, we had Nixon, we had Vietnam, so very similar circumstances to what we've just had in the last administration. And he was really thinking, I'm going to go live somewhere else. I don't even want to live in America. But he decided to take this walk first, and he walked from New York to Mobile. And he purposely walked through the South because he grew up in the Northeast, and he had always been told that everybody in the South were rednecks, and they were all racists. And so he wanted to find out for himself if that was true. And he found it to be exactly the opposite. And he found at the end of his journey that the American people were the best, greatest, most kind people in the world, and it really changed his whole perspective. And so that was one of the reasons I wanted to do the walk in the first place, to sort of say, okay, well, let's check 30 years later and see how things are going. And now the bike trip, the same thing, and I'm finding out exactly the same thing. People are good. People in America are good, and they are hopeful, and they are somewhat optimistic. They want things to improve. They want good things for the country. So I tend to have to agree with some of them after I talk to them for a while about the whole media thing, where they say, it seems the media focuses on the people that are always telling you exactly the opposite of what you're hearing from us, and the negativity. And I'm thinking, you know, they may have a point. You know, it's the people who want to be noticed are the ones that are getting all the attention, and it's not necessarily a reflection of what the country really is like.
How has the trip changed you?
Oh, it's made me much more open too, much more receptive to opening up to people, to talking to people. I was telling a friend of mine, it was interesting during the hike particularly, and to a certain extent during this bike trip, the intensity of my short relationships with the people that I meet. I mean, I may see somebody, have lunch with them, be with them for an hour, but the level of the conversation becomes immediately very intimate, and people tell me things I don't think they'd tell their priest. But I guess it's just because I'm passing through and they won't necessarily see me again. And it gives them a chance to unburden themselves if they have some things that are troubling them. And so I have some amazing encounters with people, very, very powerful meetings. And it has made me much more open to that, and to be open to hear what people really have on their minds, and also to share with them things that are very important to me. So that has fundamentally, I think, changed me over the course of the trips.
What's been your most memorable conversation or encounter?
Well, I think I think what I've discovered is I'm really discovering, particularly in the rural areas, the importance of religion in America. I mean, that is such a tremendously powerful force for people in these small communities. And so I've had some very interesting conversations with people about their faith and about their convictions. And those have been probably the most memorable things. To sort of change the subject and not so much talk about the memorable conversations, memorable events. When I went on the hike originally, I work with a bunch of type A people who always plan everything out, and they always want to make sure that everything's completely organized. I've never been quite that much. I'm somewhat type A, but I'm also sort of a fly by the seat of my pants type of guy. And so they said, well, now you've made reservations, you know where you're going to be staying every night. And I said, no, I don't care. I said, I don't even care what's over the next hill. I said, every day to me, I want it to be a surprise. I don't want to know where I'm going to end up every day. That to me is part of the journey. And then the second thing that people said the most was, aren't you afraid to go by yourself? Because I've done both of these journeys by myself. And they said, because there's so many mean people out there. And I said, well, I don't think there are that many mean people out there. And I said, I'm really not afraid to go do it by myself. And so I'm actually working on a book about the hike, and the working title of it is Journey Without Reservations, because I had no reservations either way. I didn't have any reservations. I didn't make any reservations. And so, and as I went on the hike, I also began to feel safer the more I went. I just felt like people would watch out for me wherever I went. And to sort of have the religious connection is, I was about 4 days into the hike, and I was walking down this road, and I hadn't seen anybody. I was in South Georgia at the time. Hadn't seen anybody for several hours, and suddenly this farmhouse kind of came up on the right, and I was thinking, wow, what a neat farmhouse. It had the rusty tin roof, and it had all these mixed-match chairs on the front porch. It looked very inviting. When suddenly seven heads popped up from the porch. There were seven pit bulls unleashed, and they came charging down towards me, and I thought, well, this could be interesting. And in the back of my mind, I remembered a lady that I worked with at my station who said, now, aren't you afraid about roving bands of pit bulls? And I said, well, no, I hadn't even thought about that, as a matter of fact. And she said, and this is what was funny, too, and I never followed up with her exactly what that meant. She said, I'm from Kansas. I know about that. So I don't know about Kansas. Maybe they have roving bands of pit bulls in Kansas, but that came up to my mind. And so I thought, what am I going to do? And then all of a sudden I started remembering everything people had told me since I was a kid about encounters with hostile dogs, you know, don't let them see your eyes. Well, I had my sunglasses on, so I said, okay, they can't see my eyes. The other one was be the alpha dog, you know, kind of fake them out. And I said, well, there's seven of them. What am I going to do? And also the same lady who had gotten me thinking about it made me buy a little bit of pepper spray. But I mean, this was a little pepper spray container about the size of a chapstick, and it had maybe like six squirts in it. And so I thought, well, no way. I said, maybe if the seven pit bulls would all sit in a row quietly and let me go up and spray each one of them individually, I might have a chance. But I thought, no, that's not going to happen. So they were coming down. And then I thought, well, maybe they won't cross the road, because I was on the opposite side of the road walking with traffic, facing traffic, that is. And no, they started coming right across the road. Well, about that time, from out of nowhere, this pickup truck came down the road and stopped between me and the dogs. Three of them had already come across, but there were still four on the other side. And he laid on his horn, and he spooked the four, and they ran back up onto the porch. And this was a truck that he had the tinted windshield and the window, so I couldn't see who was in the truck at all. As soon as the four ran back up, he took off. So he was gone, and I was like, wow. And I thought, number one, I thought, well, gee, I would like to have thanked him. And number two, gee, couldn't you stay around till we make sure we get take care of these other three too? And so the other three by that time were right up where I was. And I just, at that point, just very forcefully tried to be the alpha dog. And I said, go home. And they stopped and they looked at me for a second, and then they turned and they ran up with the other four. So I walked off very fastly, very quickly at that point. When I got about a half mile away, I stopped and everything was quiet. Nothing was following me. And I looked up, and it was a beautiful sky, beautiful blue sky. And at that point, I just said, you know, I didn't need to see who was in that truck. I know who was driving that truck. And I just felt, you know, that was sort of my religious experience on the hike. And I was like, you know, I don't feel scared at all now. And I didn't the rest of the hike. And that night when I got to my campsite, I threw that canister of pepper spray away. Never thought about it the rest of the hike. Never had another problem. It was just, that was, you know, suddenly I just felt, okay, I'm going to be all right.
That was Gabe Buller talking with WUWF Radio Executive Director Pat Crawford about his trip along the Underground Railroad. There's more at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, the national anthem at sporting events, why it's becoming so popular to have national recording artists perform at major events. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with local author Tanya James about her novel, Atlas of the Unknowns. First, Churchill Downs invited Leanne Rimes to sing the national anthem at this year's Kentucky Derby, marking the first time it's had a national recording artist sing the song at the event. Elizabeth Kramer reports on why the Derby has begun what it's calling a new tradition and what it means.
Oh, can you see by the dawn's early light?
Singing the Star Spangled Banner is old hat for Leanne Rimes. By the time she was 10, Rimes was singing the song at Dallas Cowboys football games. But it was a rendition during a Texas Rangers baseball game that caught the attention of songwriter Bill Mack, who chose her to record Blue, a song that became Rhymes' breakthrough hit. Rhymes still performs the national anthem before games, like this performance before the 2006 Rose Bowl. Rhymes and other artists could be singing these gigs out of patriotism, but of course it's also for the exposure via television viewers. And Rhymes' performance at the Kentucky Derby is intended to expose a widespread audience to horse racing, says Julie Koenig, the vice president of the entertainment business unit at Churchill Downs Incorporated.
We've got a lot of individuals that are watching the Derby telecast. We've got very strong rating at the time that we're getting close to race time.
The highest number of viewers who've tuned in to watch the Derby is near 15 million, and Rhymes' performance could push that higher. This year, the company is also working other angles to cultivate new racing fans. It's featuring more celebrities at the track and working with NBC, which airs the Derby, and Bravo, which NBC owns, to cover fashion and food associated with the race. The moves come as sponsorships and ticket sales have fallen off. Still, messing with the national anthem isn't always a safe bet. According to Ken Levine, he's a television writer who now has a post-game show covering the Los Angeles Dodgers. In his 20 years as a Major League Baseball announcer, he's heard his share of interpretations, and he's formed some strong opinions about how the national anthem should be sung.
The truth of the matter is, this is not a blues song. This is not a song that needs, you know, a hook or a personal signature. It's not the Grand Ole Opry. It's not opera. It's the national anthem.
Levine lampooned these showy performances in an episode he co-wrote of The Simpsons. The singer was Bleeding Gums Murphy.
Oh, say, can you? I'm asking, can you?
Levine says the anthem can take on different political meanings in different times. Sometimes performances are blatantly patriotic. At other times, they've been about showing that patriotism comes in different forms. Many historians say the first non-traditional performance was before a World Series game in 1968, when the Puerto Rican artist Jose Feliciano sang a slow and bluesy version. The next year, Jimi Hendrix played the now infamous variation at Woodstock. But even today, with savvy promoters in on the act, Levine says marketing hasn't undermined the patriotic meaning, and Rhymes' decades of experience singing it might make Saturday's rendition acceptable to Levine. The only unacceptable move at the Derby, says Churchill Downs' Julie Koenig, would be having someone sing My Old Kentucky Home.
My Old Kentucky Home is something that belongs to the audience, it belongs to the state of Kentucky, it belongs to Derby fans everywhere, whether they're here in Louisville or watching and singing at home.
Churchill Downs learned that lesson in 1996, when actress Dixie Carter sang the song. It caused many Derby fans to say it spoiled the event. Koenig says they won't do that again. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Since the beginning of the modern novel, family relationships have been mined for stories. Mothers, fathers, sisters, and brothers are fodder for books the world over, and a novel from local author Tanya James continues that tradition. In her first novel, Atlas of the Unknowns, James weaves a story of two sisters trying to find their place in the world. Robin Fisher talked with James about her first novel, Families, and having a sense of place.
So let's jump right in and say that the story is of two sisters. Is it Lino and Anjou?
Yes, Lino and Anjou.
Why sisters?
Well, I guess I mean, I have two sisters, so sisterhood is something that's, you know, very close to my heart. And I did want to sort of investigate the dynamic between these two sisters. While they're not exactly like the relationship that I have with my sisters, it still seemed a rich theater to explore because of all the kind of conflict and antagonism and sort of love that's all kind of coexisting. Yeah.
You had actually said in an earlier interview, and hopefully we'll get this quote right, that family is just a wonderful theater for fiction. And I wondered if you sometimes feel that you walk a fine line between your family and your fiction. You know, do they ever read your stories or you read your novel and they're like, is that me? Because I'm not like that. I mean, is that me?
Yes. I mean, both sisters, after I was finished with the novel, well, actually, I think my younger sister, her first question was, I better not be this younger sister. And, You know, there's a little bit of me in every character. There's, you know, I steal, I think, tiny things. You know, I think a lot of characters I write are kind of composites of many different people, and many different quirks. But I very rarely take major things from my own life or my parents' life. Although here and there, you know, my father's stories of growing up, childhood stories, are sprinkled throughout, which I think add a nice kind of regional texture to the India sections. But for the most part, I try not to sort of eviscerate the family, the family secrets or things like that. I tried to keep that out of my fiction.
That's somebody else's work.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about Lino and Anju. From the early part of the book, it seems like, you know, it seems obvious to the reader, well, you know, Lino's going to be the one left at home. She's had the injury. She's, you know, then the golden girl leaves and goes to America. And then things turn. And I wondered, when you started writing the book, did you know that? Or did these characters take on a life of their own?
I think I had an intuitive sense that it would work out that way. It just seemed to me that Anju's perceptions of America, her sort of romanticization of it, her assumption that her life will, you know, change for the better, seemed too neat. And also, you know, I certainly, you know, the quickest way to boring your reader is to not have conflict. And so I wanted those sort of high hopes to be dashed somehow. And I also kind of feel like these are pretty normal assumptions that a lot of people make when thinking about the traditional kind of immigrant narrative, and that, you know, if you stay behind, you'll go nowhere. If you come to America, you will, you know, achieve every possible goal. And I think I was thinking sort of in the back of my head, you know, I kind of want to turn that on its head a little bit.
Well, Lino, to me, is the heroine of the novel.
Mm.
She's definitely the, I guess, the linchpin. It was interesting when I was reading it it's really at the end of the book, when she's a child again, and she's at the beach with part mm-hmm. of her family, and she's writing her name in the sand, and Anju keeps walking past her and wanting the stick and everything. And it just sort of hit me that, you know, whether it's her written signature or her painted signature or just her personal presence, it's her signature that unifies the story.
Mm.
Just like it's her signature that changes Anju's life.
Yeah, I think that's a great reading. I agree. I feel like in the beginning, Lino is the passive kind of character to whom things happen, and Anju is the one who sort of is the active one who's trying to change. I mean, her announcement is that she's going to change everyone's lives, but over the course of the story, that sort of seesaws in the other direction, and Lino becomes the one through her sort of art, her creative talents, her entrepreneurship. She's the one who sort of takes a more active role in the you know, financial status of her family and in her own kind of standing, and in her own sense of herself. She's the one who has all the agency.
Do you feel that you have a good ear for everyday situations? And the reason that I'm asking is because fairly early in the book where Anju is called into the principal's office. You know, that was a lovely piece of writing because it was so observant. You know, Anju makes the comment about the foreboding intimacy of that scene, which made it all the more real because, you know, you can think back to times when you were a child and the more trouble you were in, the nicer people were before they delivered the bad news.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you intentionally eavesdrop, or is this just something that you think is innate? You just have a way of reading a situation.
Well, I think if I'm at my best in the writing process, I really am sort of imagining from within a character and looking out, and I sort of lose the self-consciousness of myself writing a person. Instead, the person is writing itself on the page, I guess, if that makes any sense. But So in that situation, I think I'm sure in earlier drafts it probably was more self-conscious, and I think with more and more drafts, as I become closer to the character and you know, the sort of enormity of that experience becomes clearer to me. Whereas, you know, if I maybe in an earlier draft I might have been, you know, it's a meeting with a teacher and a principal. It's huge to her, but it's not, you know, the worst thing that could happen in the world. But so I guess the challenge is, I guess through detail or through emotional nuance, making the reader feel the enormity that character feels in that moment.
Well, it was a hold your breath scene. Mm-hmm. I have to say, the more that it starts to dawn on her that, you know, something's not right here. You know, they're calling me by my first name. And it really was very powerful.
Thank you.
I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about Indian American writers, because the public seems to be in love with people who write about India. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I think that Indians have been writing in English for a very long time. Actually, one of the earliest novels I read was by I think Raja Rao, and it was set in the 40s. And I mean, he wrote it in the 40s, but. So it seems to me that it's a shift. It's not that Indians haven't been writing in English, but that there has been a shift in attention. But I'm not sure. I kind of think that I think that the challenge is to write about a world that might be far from the reader's experience, but to sort of channel what is universal about the emotional experience of the events that are taking place. And even if a fascination begins from wanting to know, I want to read about a world that's really different from mine, or a town that's really remote from my own. I think that if the fiction is working at its best, then it's, you know, bringing a kind of recognition in the reader, a recognition of emotion.
I recently interviewed Thridi Amrugar. Mm. I don't know if you're yes. Familiar with her. Mm-hmm. But in her latest novel, her main characters are an American couple. She worries about getting India right, since she has lived in the U.S. for so long. Do you find yourself wondering that too? Wondering how your Indian readers or your readers in India or your family in Kerala will read it and go, she didn't get that right.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's very important. I think that's also, for me, maybe I feel an added challenge, because I was born here, and so my parents were born in Kerala, and so I do feel that there's that authenticity is important, and it's just as important that a reader, a Western reader, would feel that the world rings true. I think that's as important as a reader from Kerala feeling that the world rings true, which is why I kind of took the research maybe to an extreme level. You know, I felt that it was really important that there was a currency to the way that Kerala was being depicted, and so I was kind of fact-checking to an obscene level, you know, like just, you know, trying to talk to anyone who lives there and get people to read it, people who live there, I didn't want to write about a place based on any kind of generalizations.
You've been listening to Robin Fisher talking with local author Tanya James about her first novel, Atlas of the Unknowns. James will read from her book at Carmichael's Bookstore Saturday afternoon at 4. For more information, visit our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at wfpl.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.